Hello, and welcome to this episode and a special set of episodes of the Decarceration Nation podcast from the Smart on Crime Innovations Conference in New York City. I say we because I'm thrilled that our web guru, Robert Alvarez, was able to join me in New York City for the conference. As a result, Robert and I got to interview several thought leaders in the criminal justice reform field. The episode you're about to hear is one of a series of five interviews, which we'll be releasing over the next 2.5 weeks. Each episode will be intentionally shorter than our normal episodes, running from this, they'll probably be running between 20 and 30 minutes. Okay, here we go. I hope you enjoy these special Decarceration Nation podcast episodes from the 2019 Smart on Crime Conference.
Hello, this is Robert Alvarez, and I'm here with Josh B. Ho. We are Decarceration Nation, and we're live from the Smart on Crime Innovations Conference 2019 at John Jay College. I'll be introducing Rachel Rollins. She is the District Attorney of Suffolk County in Massachusetts, which includes the municipalities of Boston, Chelsea, Revere, and Winthrop. Josh?
Welcome to the Decarceration Nation, Rachel.
Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I'm going to start off in kind of a weird place because we have more important things to discuss. But I know you also worked for the NFL, but I'm a lifelong rabid basketball fan, so I have to ask what it was like working as the first legal intern in history at the National Basketball Association's Players Association.
It was unreal. I have been a rabid basketball fan myself. Growing up in Boston, you cannot be a basketball fan, or we had Larry Bird and Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale. We had some really good teams. And then we had the, not the same trifecta, but with Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce. But I was adamant. I was relentless. And when Alex English, who was the then, for the older, your older listeners who might know who that is.
I certainly remember
yeah,
Alex
English. Of course. He actually called me to say, we will accept you as an intern. I thought he was calling to say, if you keep sending us things or calling us, we're going to get a restraining order against you, because I was so interested in being an intern there. I learned a great deal. That summer that I was there, they were actually negotiating their collective bargaining agreement. The Bill Cartwright grievance, where he had left, he was with the Supersonics and there was an issue there. He had gone from being a player to being a sort of coach or recruiting, and the team wasn't paying him as a player. And it was an almost $1 million discrepancy that we would represent players in grievances. And then part of my job was, you know, explaining to the players all of the proposed changes in the collective bargaining agreement. So it was a wonderful summer. Patrick Ewing, who you know is obviously from Massachusetts, was actively involved. It was like surreal every day going to work.
Yeah, it would have blown me away. I kind of grew up with the Patrick Ewing versus Jordan Bowles.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a huge part of my
But he went to high school in Cambridge, so
oh, yeah?
He is, which is where my family lives. So, you know, just being an exceptional high school basketball player playing at Georgetown and then the Knicks.
And I also remember him at Georgetown, obviously, was just when he was the whole Hoya mania.
Oh, my God. I know.
Crazy good stuff.
Crazy good stuff.
So, rapid change of subject.
Yeah, right?
So, you were a prosecutor, mm-hmm. and then you kind of come back and as a progressive prosecutor. Can you talk about how the experience the first time kind of informed your move to when you ran as a progressive prosecutor?
Absolutely. So, I was an assistant United States attorney at the federal level, and I was basically a cog in a wheel. I was an entry-level lawyer, and I realized very, very quickly that entry-level people don't set policy. I also recognize that in the federal system, neither does the U.S. attorney, right? Mm-hmm. So the U.S. attorney in Massachusetts, we only have one. New York, for example, has several. But they are appointed by the Attorney General of the United States, who, of course, is appointed by the president. So our current U.S. attorney, who's a former colleague of mine, his agenda is essentially the sitting president and the Attorney General Barr's agenda. And so I recognize not only do entry-level prosecutors not have any policy-making authority, but on the federal system, it's really dictated down from D.C. I then recognize that even though we were doing really important work, the overwhelming majority of the people that are in our jails and prisons across the country are prosecuted by state and local sort of prosecutors, not the federal system. And I left the U.S. Attorney's Office And then started doing some sort of more administrative jobs. I was the head lawyer for three of the largest organizations, state agencies in Massachusetts. But while I was at a big firm before the U.S. Attorney's Office, I had done a DA rotation, and I knew that that's really where the change could happen. So, I took those experiences, and quite frankly, after with the rise in cell phones and the ability to see things instantly and not have... I'm old, so I'm 48, so you don't
I'm
wait...
I'm older than you,
oh, well,
so...
you look good. But, you don't have to wait to open the newspaper to see what it is that happened the night before. And you might not even know if the newsroom shut at midnight, something could have happened. This young person's like, what are you talking about? but right now we live in an immediate world where we get an alert because something just happened 30 seconds ago somewhere and we have footage and we can see it. I was just seeing too many people having interactions with law enforcement where they lost their lives. And remember, the police and law enforcement are the only branch of our government that have the ability to take away our life with no oversight in an instant, right? So it's not like the IRS where we're sorry, sir, we took an extra $3,000 from you and you get to write a sternly worded letter and get your money back later, right? Or the RMV who might look at you and even if they're racist, like to me, hey, we don't serve your kind here. I can make a complaint and in 2 weeks I get my license, even though I've been inconvenienced for that short amount of time. When there are embedded, sort of ingrained thought processes in law enforcement and communities that feel over-policed and over-prosecuted, and we see situations where overwhelmingly these poor black and brown men and women are coming into contact and not making it out alive, I just said we need new people in the role of DA so that there can at least be a chance that the DA might say, you know what, we're going to open an investigation into this one. And I was seeing too many where we weren't. And then overwhelmingly, it's a male game, right? And men are great. This is not a bashing moment. But I just think the more voices we have at a table, the better we're going to be as a company. Forget about criminal justice reform or, you know, the carceral system or IT or whatever it is. If we can get some people from some different countries, different experiences, different genders, different ages, we are going to be so much better thinking about solutions. And that's why I put my hat in.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's actually a good bridge. You know, when I launched this podcast a couple years ago on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, mm-hmm. Because of my own experience in the criminal justice system. And I often say that you'd have to be willfully blind to walk into a jail or prison in the United States without seeing the racial disparities. Part of your goal has been to confront this problem head on. How do you think we can all best embrace reform, but also insist on racial justice in this country?
Sure, and I think people are willfully blind. There are very few people that actually set foot in jails and prisons. And part of what I did as a candidate, and you know, I'm 9 months old as a DA, I'm 48 years old as a human, and 20 years old as a lawyer, but 9 months old as a DA. As a candidate, I went into our houses of corrections and our departments of corrections. And I forced myself to, and not just the close ones, the ones that are, Massachusetts isn't big, but, you know, we are a solid, maybe 3 hour tip-to-tip drive, let's say. The ones that are over an hour, maybe up to 2 hours away. And as a candidate I visited, I was really proud to say that I got endorsed by the two architects of our criminal justice reform legislation, two senators, but I also got five endorsements from behind the wall. And, you know, I had national, state, and local endorsements from Emerge and other, Sean King and other, you know, sort of great activists. But I promised some of those overwhelmingly men that when I won, I would come back and see them monthly. And so as the DA, I have gone in to the Department of Corrections, Norfolk in Massachusetts, and met with a group of overwhelmingly lifers. And we talk about policy, and I make sure that I made sure for myself that it was going to be Norfolk, because I knew that when I got this job, I'd be busy. And I knew that I wouldn't have 4 hours in a day to give to see these men. And I wanted to remind myself of the agitation every time I thought, oh, shit, is it that today? All right, well, I can't do this. But I'm driven in a Tahoe by a armed executive protection from Boston Police Department. I'm on my phone. I'm doing work. I'm whisked in because I'm the DA, and I meet with them. So imagine what a family feels like when they don't have a Tahoe, an armed guard. I'm serious, right? They have to take an Uber. None of these places are accessible by public transportation. I'm treated. There have been times where I've been treated poorly, and I'm the DA. Imagine what a family feels like who doesn't understand the system, or a grandmother who is wearing an underwire bra, or an 80-year-old who has pants on that don't fit the criteria of what it is. She's not there to be sexually active. She's there to see her grandchildren. So it's just, it reminds me. So I will push back and say people are being willfully blind because they aren't going in there. And what I did was, not only am I going, I have a new set of assistant district attorneys that started. And in addition to learning how to do arraignments and bails, I made them go into Nashua Street, which is where we send people. It's our house of corrections when you can't afford your bail. I don't care if you understand how to ask for bail. I want you to see the facility we send people to when they can't afford it, number one. Number two, I had criminal defense attorneys speak to them. I had returning citizens, and not small crimes, people that have served 17 years in federal prison, gang, gun, and drug cases, serious individuals, because they need to know that these people, when they return, have turned their lives around, and we shouldn't be branding them with respect to the worst part of their life, right? Possibly. So again, I think we have to pull the blinders off. We need prosecutors that show up themselves and then demand that their staff does as well.
Yeah, I was only in for a short time, but I know in my own experience that one of the things you learn very early on is that lifers are often the most engaged in trying to change the system and the most invested, even though they may never get out, sure, in trying to create a better system. I just testified last week in Michigan about the need to stop incarcerating so many people for misdemeanors. I know this was one of your core issues during the campaign and since. Can you talk just a little bit more about how you approach the problem and how things have been going in reducing prosecutions for low-level crimes?
Absolutely. So I am basically the CEO of a 350-person law firm. And we handle about 25,000 to 35,000 cases a year, budget of about $21 million. I have limited resources. And if right now, as of today, we've had 34 homicides since January 1st in Suffolk County, Massachusetts, we have a 20% solve rate in non-fatal shootings, which is not good for the non-mathers. That's bad, right? Like, as in 80% of the times a non-fatal shooting happens, we don't solve it. Let's put our money and most of our efforts there. No one's saying that with trespassing and shoplifting that it's a free-for-all and you can do that. But there are ways that we can issue civil fines. We can do stay-away orders. The overwhelming percentage, I will comfortably say 50% of the people that touch our municipal and district court systems for low-level misdemeanor, non-violent, non-serious crimes, mental health issues, substance use disorder, homelessness, hunger. Those four things, not every person, but the overwhelming majority, I would be comfortable to say. And what I want to do is get you food, a place to live, some treatment for your mental health issues, or treatment for your substance use disorder. And accountability isn't even the right word when you have a health issue, right? And so I will push back and say, with the opioid crisis we have right now in the United States, it's the health crisis that it's always been. But when it was the 80s and 90s and it was black people and Latinx people and it was crack cocaine, nobody gave a shit. Excuse my language. I don't know what type of podcast this is. Okay. All right. But anyway, you get it, right? Nobody cared. It was arrest, arrest, get them out of here. It's a problem. Now that it could be the president's kid or the governor's kid or this legislator's kid, miraculously it's turned into this health issue. It always was. Who I am as the DA is I don't mince words. I'm brutally honest. And I think that's going to allow communities to feel comfortable and say, well, wait a minute. Did the district attorney just say that there are racial disparities? Yes, that's exactly what I said. Let's marinate in that uncomfort for a moment, but then move forward. How are we going to... We can't just stay in the uncomfort. We can't just tantrum and say, like, it's not fair, it's not fair. It isn't fair. But this train is moving. Let's at least have the right conversations. Get some people that have been deeply impacted by injustice, wrong, racial inequities, and straight-up prejudice at the table with us so we don't do it again and think of solutions. So for me, I have a list of 15 crimes that in the first instance we aren't going to think about incarceration. But it's buckets, right? It's, if you are somebody who's never done this before in your life, you are obviously on some substance right now. I want to null pros you and hopefully get you into a program. As in, you are not branded with a record. You are not even arraigned. I have the authority to do that. If it's you and you've done this two or three times, maybe four times in the last year or two, depending on what it is, if it's a, you know, receiving stolen property but under a certain amount that's a misdemeanor or a shoplifting, maybe I ask the judge, Your Honor, can you give him 8 hours of community service and then dismiss it, right? Or whatever. But if it's me and this is the fifth time I've done this in the last 3 weeks, I'm getting arraigned. Even if there are some significant issues. And then what I think people don't understand is self-harm our community has a lot of empathy for or sympathy for. But when you turn that onto our community, so we had a person, significant mental health issues, but she stabbed an EMS worker and brutally stabbed this person. She is being held in a facility where she's getting treatment, which is ideal for her, but also keeping the community safe, right? So I am fully capable. I'm not soft on crime. I'm smart on crime, right? You see, I worked in the name of the team. Right? Exactly. Yeah, but we're smart because we are actually saving the community money and we're investing our resources in the things that are violent and not keeping us safe.
So I have a couple of friends who are running as progressives become district attorneys right now, one in Michigan and one right here in New York City. You might actually be visiting me here in a little bit. What have you learned since you won that could help other progressive prosecutors as they move into these jobs? So I'm sure, having followed some of the story of what's been happening with you, I'm sure you've got a lot to say here.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say to them, I'm proud of you. Because stepping up and putting yourself out there to run for office, whether it's DA or anything, is brave, right? Because it's very easy to, you know, jeer from the sidelines and not get involved and do anything. So number one, I'm proud of them. Number two, it's a tough game, right? Like there are approximately 2,400 prosecutors across the country on the state level or local level. And there's only about 30 to 40 of us right now that are considered progressive. So, you know, it's like the X-Men, right? Like we're the Justice League. There aren't many of us. So, you know, it's always wonderful to see somebody who has like wings or your eyes turn into something. I don't know what X-Men do, but you get it, right? Like I just, what I want to them.
Old comic bookie, exactly.
Right. You gotta, I want them to hear me say, reach out to us, ask us for help, right? I endorsed Tiffany Caban. Mm-hmm. She was ultimately not successful in Queens, but I was so impressed with her drive and her passion.
Real close.
Very close. I have endorsed Chesa Boudin, who's out in San Francisco now. George Gaston is not running for San Francisco DA. I'm hoping that he might be considering running for DA somewhere else, but we will grill you and we will hopefully endorse you or... I would argue I'm like the second round, you know, maybe even the third round of progressive prosecutors. You have the Marilyn Mosbys and the Stephanie Moraleses that were in 2015. You have the Kim Foxes in Cook County, Chicago, and then the Larry Krasners who came after her, and then Wesley Bell, who's in St. Louis, and myself, and Sitana DeBerry, for example, in North Carolina. There's another sort of group of us there. I would encourage them to Google us, like call us, get some of our policies, see whether you agree with us or not. And we've done a lot of the hard work already. Don't recreate the wheel, but get ready, because it's like an all-you-can-eat pie-eating contest. And then the prize is more pie, right? Which you're like, but I just don't want any more pie. So, but I will say, you're going to gear up. I had a primary that I won. It was five of us. I won with over 40% of the vote in my primary. And then I had an opponent for the general. We won with over 80% of the vote in the general. That was November 6th. I got a transition team together, put on some returning citizens, got reamed by the media, because it's like you're letting the fox in the hen house type of stuff. But I'm like, why wouldn't we have people that actually understand our system talking to us about how our system works, right? And I don't want all law enforcement here. And then I started work January 2nd, and it's been like drinking out of a fire hose since then. So honestly, it's just reach out to us. We're here. I'm working as much as I can to try to keep my eye on some of these races and offer myself. But we are freedom fighters. We really are. And what I like to remind people is, you can have the best criminal defense attorney in the world. If the prosecutor won't even pick up the call to discuss a plea, you're going to trial. And that's not fair, but that's the system that we have. And ultimately, I believe it's a system that, you know, people like to say it's broken. It's actually working exactly the way it was set up to work. Poor people don't bode well in this system, unless you understand it's like playing a video game. You need the key card, right? Like, you need all the codes. And if you don't have
all the
them,
cheat codes.
Yeah, the cheat codes. But I'm like old school Atari person, right? Like, I'm not this
I
guy.
I may still have
I know,
original
my
Atari
God,
back at home.
We're going to be friends after this, right?
I really
anyways,
actually
yeah.
do. That.
But you get it, right? Like, yeah. you need really good people that understand how much power this office holds to start dismantling some of those. These systems that are set up to let the house win every time, right? And so I look at that and say, it is my honor to be the DA. I worked very hard to get here. And on the hard days, I look at myself and say, stop complaining. You fought, you ran for this office and won twice, you know, but it is
for the pie.
My God, it's more pie. but I will tell you, it's an honor and a privilege to do my job every day.
So, this is kind of to build on that, you know, we're all kind of part of a growing multifaceted movement for reform. It could be said we've come, I think, a long way in a relatively short time. But where do you think we are, and what do you think the biggest problem we still are facing as a movement from your perspective is?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in the beginning of a really, I hope, a wave, right, of more people stepping up and recognizing and paying attention. Like, what I think was really great, the ACLU had a nationwide sort of campaign, and they did it in Massachusetts. It was called What a Difference a DA Makes, right? And so they educated the public. They couldn't endorse a candidate, but just most people think the judge is the most powerful person in the courtroom. Most people think the police, but the police arrest, right? If the DA null process, you don't even have to go before a judge for us to null process. What a lot of people don't understand is we don't even ask a judge, Your Honor, can you enter this? Can you approve this null process? It's just entered, right? Like, so we are the sort of centerpiece of, you don't get into the courthouse without us, and nobody gets, probation doesn't get involved unless the DA says, here you go, Your Honor, we're asking for the following. So I think where we are is, I want this to be a multi-headed, you know, monster, where we're looking at DAs, but we also need to look at sheriffs, right? We also need to look at who our governors are, because if they appoint your, Executive Office of Public Safety, like in Massachusetts, that person controls all the departments of corrections. So in Massachusetts, our sheriffs are elected. There's 16 of them. And you, if you do time up to 2.5 years, you go to a house of corrections. Anything 2.5 years all the way up to natural life, because we don't have the death penalty, it's Department of Corrections. That's Secretary Turco. Our facilities are not great. The treatment and care that people get there is not good. And that's not even a whack at the secretary. It's that we have a 67% recidivism rate. So if you were manufacturing cars and 67% of those cars came back as, like, you know, when I turn my radio on, my seat flies out and my whole family's ejected, you'd be, that would be awesome, by the way, but if you lived,
we need parachutes.
Right, exactly, parachutes and everyone lives. But you get it, that you'd be shut down immediately, right? Like, so what are we doing with the people when we send there? And people love to say, oh, stay in your lane. What I want to say is progressive prosecutors recognize my lane is housing. My lane is education. My lane is environmental racism and classism, right? Because it's poor people that get all the dumping grounds from these companies, right? And it's poor people that are marketing, you know, vaping, right? And cigarettes and all, you know, alcohol and guns on every corner. So in addition to that, I say it's prisons and houses of correct and jails. Because if they're coming back to me, and you're failing them, then I need to look in and see what's going on there, right? And so you need bold, you need a backbone. Like, to go back to the question before that, it's a constant fight. You know, it's a constant fight, and it is lonely because there aren't many of us. And, you know, the media changes incredibly hard. You know this. Everyone wants the result but doesn't want to go through all of the work to get there. And we are in the throes of the work right now. So I think the next wave is, I hope to see a lot of people from multiple backgrounds stepping up to say, I want to be the DA. And then also that people are, you know, the voting public is demanding more from candidates. And I will just share, if you are a candidate that cares, and, you know, for me, I was 47 when I ran. I wasn't doing this for shits and giggles, right? Like, I wanted to be the DA. I thought, how am I going to win, right? I started from, you know, my acceptance speech on September 4th, working backwards, or my get out the vote. What is my 15-second thing I want to be able to say to you? I want to be able to say, I have the Globe endorsement. I have over 75 endorsements, national, state, and local. Emerge, the women's group. I am the only candidate that's ever managed more than 5 people. And I have an office of 300. I've handled budgets of whatever. And I was able to do all that because I planned it out accordingly. I would say we need the public educated on what DAs do, what qualifications you need to be exceptional there, and how the system really impacts the rest of the community. And it's not in a positive way.
So we're at the Smart on Crime Innovations Conference. I know you're speaking in a bit. Do you want to give a little preview about what you're
sure.
going to talk about?
So I'm actually on a panel where, you know, it's like, can DAs and can prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys get along, right? Like, are we the coyote and the sheepdog from Bugs Bunny, right? But and what's great is we can, right? Progressive prosecutors understand that, you know, criminal defense lawyers, public defenders are us. They understand everything we do, just like we should understand what they do, but many of us don't, because they're standing right there every time we stand up to prosecute, right? So they are a huge part of the system. And I think in our municipal and district courts, it does not need to be nearly as adversarial as it is. We can save that for the superior courts, where in Massachusetts, we indict up for those serious crimes. And I think ultimately, if our goal is to help the people that come into contact with the system, we should be working together. And so part of what I did was, at this graduation, I had the chief counsel for the public defenders, Anthony Benedetti. He was my personal guest at this event, where the mayor and the commissioner of police and a couple other chiefs of police from all my different around my county was there, but I gave him a personal shout out and had him stand up and thanked him for his work. I think we can start sort of messaging differently, right? If I show you value and respect and I'm the leader of this organization, then I demand that my staff or the people that I work with, my peers, do the same to their peers. And then also we had, as I think I mentioned earlier, my group of ADAs, the assistant district attorneys, coming in. They visited Nashua Street. They had a panel of public defenders and criminal defense attorneys. They had a panel of survivors and victims. They had a panel of judges. They had a panel of probation officers. And they had a panel of defendants and significant defendants, as we had said earlier. So I think you got to put your money where your mouth is, right? Like, it's very easy to say, like, we value everyone, or have really nice slogans on the wall. But if when you walk into your job, you feel like shit every day, I don't care what that poster says. My boss treats me poorly and only, you know, men are promoted. Or you have to have gone to this school. I don't care what color, race, gender you are. If you went to Harvard, you're going to succeed here. But if you didn't, you aren't. So it's the culture, and we have to make sure that leadership, I take that role very, very seriously.
Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's a real pleasure to get to meet you.
It was awesome to talk to you guys. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you too.
Thank you.
All right.
Hope you enjoyed that special episode of Decarceration Nation. Any content from the Smart on Crime Conference was courtesy of the Center for American Progress, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. And make sure to check out our new t-shirts, sweatshirts, and hats. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, and to Robert Alvarez, who's been helping with the website. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.